Shrink Wrap Radio number 306, The Now Effect with Elisha Goldstein, PhD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is psychologist Dr. Elisha Goldstein, and we'll be discussing his new book, The Now Effect, How This Moment Can Change the Rest of Your Life. Elisha Goldstein, PhD, is in private practice in West Los Angeles, and he is the author of the 2012 book, The Now Effect. He's also the co-author of A Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Workbook, with a foreword by Jon Kabat-Zinn. He synthesizes the pearls of traditional psychotherapy with a progressive integration of mindfulness to achieve mental and emotional healing. He contends that we have the power to transform our traumas and habitual patterns that keep us stuck in perpetual cycles of stress, anxiety, depression, or addiction, and step into greater freedom and peace. He offers practical strategies to calm our anxious minds, transform negative emotions, and facilitate greater self-acceptance, freedom, and inner peace. Dr. Goldstein comes from a family of psychologists, and he advocates that mental health comes from an approach that looks at all aspects of the self, physical, mental, emotional, and even spiritual. As a licensed psychologist, he teaches mindfulness-based programs in his own Los Angeles practice and through Insight LA. To learn more about Dr. Goldstein, please go to our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Elisha Goldstein, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's great to be here, David. Great to be back.
Well, it's hard to believe it's been 4 years since we spoke about your work on mindfulness-based stress reduction. Seems like it was just yesterday.
Wow, yeah, it does.
I'm really impressed by how productive you've been during the intervening 4 years with writing, producing CDs, workshops, interviews, now this book, and you tell me that you're working on another one?
Yeah. It's all going along the same line of putting work out there that's going to be supportive to others and as well as myself, about helping us become more present to our lives, opening up to more of the choices that are there, and living more aligned with our intentions and values.
Yeah, and I'm recalling from our previous interview that back in the 70s, you were a very intense go-go professional in the financial services industry before the big financial crash. And now I have the impression that you are a go-go psychologist with all that same intensity and drive. So my question is, what do you do in your personal life to keep things in balance, to practice what you preach, and to rein in what might be your natural type A tendencies? Is that a fair question?
Well, yeah. Well, you added some years to my life, more the 90s maybe than the 70s.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I was way off there. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So, you know, it's interesting that you touch on that, Dave, because that's one of the reasons I got into mindfulness, this idea of helping, a very practical application to life in some way of helping, you know, me become more present, more focused, more able to stay in line with, you know, my intentions and what I value, is because I'm the kind of guy whose mind is constantly thinking of many different ideas. I'm easily distracted and taken away by something that's exciting, or you know, just taking my mind into maybe some of the less exciting places as well. And so it's become very important for me to find the in-between spaces in life where I can stop and center, become focused, and get back in touch with actually what's here. Another thing that's helped me kind of walk my talk in some ways is becoming very aware of my emotional state, and understanding the fact in some way that when I can become more aware of what's happening with me emotionally and be able to meet it, especially the difficult emotions, be able to meet it with greater mindfulness, greater sense of caring about what's here, I inevitably become more in control of where I'm able to place my attention, and I feed myself the message that I'm worth enough to pay attention to, which makes me feel better. And then when you feel better, your mind's more open, or my mind's more open and able to focus on what really matters. So it's those little things. And when I say the in-between spaces, I mean, you know, there's places all throughout the day that we're unaware of that can be opportunities to tap into becoming more present. That's waiting in line, that's going to the bathroom, that's waking up in the morning, that's being in the shower, all these informal places, waiting on hold on the phone, which can be opportunities to just become more present to our lives. And I think that's really what's helped me, is understanding these in-between spaces that are there. And I'd say that's the basis in some ways for, you know, writing The Now Effect, which was, you know, helping all of us really integrate this into our lives rather than it being this approach to life where we have to be away somewhere and be in this special place and ground in this longer practice, which are all wonderful things to do too. But what's the practical applications to our lives? And that comes out of my personal experience.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I can really relate to all of that. I remember one point when I was so aware of how much my mind drifts, and I'm supposed to be a professional listener, and I'm aware that
right.
Often my mind is somewhere else and my head is nodding. And so I deliberately decided to put myself in a situation, in a life and death situation, where I would have to pay attention. I decided to become a glider pilot. Not a hang glider, but the kind of airplane without a motor. And I knew that I really needed to pay attention to what the instructor was saying, because my life would literally depend upon it. So I know what you're talking about. Now, when I first saw the title of the book, The Now Effect, I sort of thought, well, we've got Eckhart Tolle's book. I don't know how to pronounce his name. It's Tolle.
Yeah.
The Power of Now, which was a very big seller. And before that, Ram Dass's Be Here Now. And even before that, certainly a whole raft of Zen Buddhists as well as Gestalt therapy writing about the importance of being in the moment. So why the Now Effect now?
Well, you know, we also have a very wide amount of books that have come out on mindfulness in particular.
We sure have.
And the Now Effect, what I wanted to get at was, you know, this even goes beyond just the label of terms like mindfulness. It's about what's happening right now. The Power of Now, which was a wonderful book, and obviously Be Here Now sold over 1 million copies. And so that had tremendous influence on our culture, especially the field of psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
The Power of Now also, you know, a very powerful book that talks about the philosophy, a question and answer book that talks about the philosophy, as I actually learned later after I thought of the title, The Now Effect, the philosophy of what it's like to actually be here, how the past and future is, you know, all happening, you know, right now, and how we don't have to believe everything we think. In other words, at least that's what I think the essence of it is. This book is about taking, I guess, that idea of being here now and applying it very practically in our lives. The essence of this book is to, you know, take practices all throughout the book, the kind of concepts and practices, and, you know, find ways that they apply at work, in our relationships, or when it comes to our interaction with our diet, or a variety of different things. And so I kind of see it as more of a practical power of now, but it's really embracing the idea of mindfulness, which isn't really discussed as much in that book.
Right, and practical certainly is the right word. Actually, the book begins with something about your own story. So let me have you take us through the highlights of your personal journey and how this book, The Now Effect, is both a reflection of that journey and has grown out of it.
You know, it's interesting. In writing that short piece, I was kind of reluctant to write it because it was such a personal part of my life. You know, and as a psychologist, you know, we rarely share, you know, some of our most personal pieces of our history. And as I was reflecting on, you know, what to write as far as, you know, relaying to the public and everyone, what would be most helpful for them, and I decided that this piece was, this piece was it. This was about, you know, probably the most intense moment of my life, and the moment where I had, where I was washed over with a state of awareness. That's that moment, that now effect. It's a moment of clarity. Mm-hmm. It's that aha moment where we recognize what really matters to us, and you can call it a moment of mindfulness. And this was a time when I was, as you were mentioning before, I was in the corporate world, and I was working hard and playing a whole lot harder. And as long as I was successful at what I was doing, I figured everything was okay. And I used to, I could be found in the back streets of south of Market Street in San Francisco, in the various bars and clubs, out to all different hours of the night and even up for days at times. And I used to see this man that was there, and I relay this story. I used to see this man who looked like he was up for days. He was a shadow of, you know, a human being, it seemed like. And I used to tell my friends who I was with that if I was ever caught with this man, you know, I've hit rock bottom. And it was only a few weeks later after I made that comment that I was in a broken down limousine with this same man and what looked like maybe a beaten up prostitute. And I was looking for a way, you know, just to even stay up for the following days at work. And so that and in that moment when I was with him, something really kind of washed over me, which was a voice inside. It was as if I was taking a pause from this entire experience, and a voice inside rose up in me and said, you know, you're worth more than this. You don't have to do this. This doesn't have to be your life. This doesn't have to be your future. And in that moment, that was this aha moment of clarity. That's what I call the now effect. It's when we come to our truth in some way. And I took the next step and opened the door and walked outside and walked back home. And that you could do that in San Francisco because it's a small place. And, you know, that started my journey into the rest of my life, which is where I am today. Now, when we're talking about, you know, making change in our lives, whether it has to do with stress, anxiety, depression, addiction, trauma, working with trauma, or whether it has to do with just being more successful, and what we're doing, it doesn't happen so easily. It's not as if you can make a single decision and all of a sudden things start to just unfold from there. For me, you know, I found myself kind of relapsing into that same lifestyle a couple times while still working on that kind of change.
Yeah, it doesn't happen immediately, and it does take attention and repeated ongoing work.
And intention, yeah.
And intention, which we'll talk a bit about down the line here. I'm so glad that you did include that story. I kind of always, you know, am looking for some kind of self-revelation by yeah. authors, because it's the stories really that I know that pull me in. And one of the things that I love about your book is that most chapters, if not every chapter, begins with a little story. Uh-huh. So I hope you'll feel free to throw in as many stories as come to mind in our discussion here. Tell us a bit about the structure of the book. It's got a very interesting structure.
You know, I made it specifically for people like myself who don't have, you know, naturally the longest attention spans.
And I like that too.
And so each chapter is kind of a short chapter. It's like 2 or 3 pages long with a what's called a now moment at the end, which is meant yes. to pop someone into that space of clarity so they can experience in that moment either a practice or a reflection to experience the content of that chapter. Because one thing that I know, and that's been taught by many teachers in the past, is that, you know, you can read a book and or you can listen to an expert or whatever it is, and you might have some kind of insight or some connection, but real change happens from our own experience. And that's what becomes most motivating, and that's what actually creates the integration of that work. And so I created these now moments to give people the experience of the content in that chapter. I've also included 14 video links throughout the book, and these come in the form of what are called Microsoft tags. And if people have smartphones, they can point the smartphone over this tag and it'll pop up with a 2 or 3 minute video of me guiding them through a particular practice, which is very different than any book that I've really seen out there. And the purpose of it is to give someone access so I can kind of reach into their life and support them with this practice. Now, eventually, you know, you can get rid of the tool of the technology, and be able to just use these practices as they'll start becoming more automatic. And all those, by the way, all those videos, immediately as you point the phone at them, will be stored on your phone as a link. So you won't actually need to point them at the book anymore if you want to use them just in your just in your daily life. And if you don't have one of these phones, it's okay. It has a link on where the video is stored, and you can do that. And so that's kind of the content of the book. I bring people through, you know, a training ground on how to start to notice these choice points, these spaces of awareness, start to realize and experience this now effect, the effect of mindful moments in their lives. Then I help them become more aware of their mind and get space in between their awareness and their mind themselves. So again, they can experience that perspective and choice from the thoughts that they're thinking. Then after that, we're working with helping people prime their minds for good. And the purpose of that, Dave, is that we have naturally an automatic negativity bias in our brains. And that's from evolutionary from a reason that's evolutionary.
Sure.
If anyone's ever heard, you know, Rick Hansen talks a lot about this. He touches on some of the psychology out there.
Yes, I interviewed him.
Which is this idea that, you know, for those of us, our ancestors in the past who were, you know, hunters and gatherers, those of them that were sitting there mindful of the blades of grass that were there saying things like, what a wonderful blade of grass this is. I love the greenness of it. Wow, the crispness of this blade of grass. And weren't looking for the dangers around them, were most likely lunch. And so they didn't get to pass along their genes to us. It's the ones that were more anxious almost, that were looking for the dangers out there, which were perhaps the safer ones, which passed along their genes to who we are today. So in some ways, we're a refinement of thousands of years of refining in brain architecture that has our minds naturally defaulting towards the negative or to something that's more anticipatory mm-hmm. in some way. And so priming our minds for good has to be intentionally becoming aware of more of the good in our lives and cultivating this within us. And that cultivates a greater sense of resiliency. And there's a number of different neuroscience studies that attest to the benefits of this. Then after that, we talk about some of the neuroscience and some of what's going on in the actual brain itself.
Yeah.
During different parts of experience. And then we move on to working with difficult emotions, because all of this leads up to that. It's this great cartoon that's out there that says, it's a woman standing behind another woman who's holding the hand of a screaming child and says, I want to live in this moment. I want to live in the moment, just not this moment, more like a moment on the beach.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, that's the crux of the experience. It's like, I want to be, I'd like to be anywhere else but here right now. But the problem is we are here. So that dissonance itself, that resistance, that moving away creates this sense of stress, anxiety, amplifies depression, makes us move more into our addictive behaviors, whether it has to do with our phones or checking out or drugs, alcohol, whatever it is, and also exacerbates our experience of trauma.
Yeah. You've just covered a lot of ground here, and
sorry about that.
We're all survivors. That's one thing that strikes me is when you think about it genetically, as you say, and you think back to all the ancestors that each one of us has had, and all the people that didn't make it, and somehow we're, for each one of us that's alive now, we're in a chain of people that made it, that survived. And I'm a technophile, so I was really intrigued by those Microsoft tags or QR codes, or sometimes they're called two-dimensional barcodes. And I got out my iPhone and I was really struck by how it, like, the iPhone would sort of automatically focus on that thing, and boom, it brought up you in a little YouTube video. And also there was a link to a supplementary related kind of video on YouTube, something related to mindfulness or meditation or something like that. I was curious why you went with Microsoft tags rather than the QR tags I see in my newspaper and magazines that seem to me more widespread.
Yeah. Well, that was a good question. That was my publisher who decided that, Simon and Schuster. And the reason they did that is because the Microsoft tags are, you know, for just aesthetic reasons, are a lot prettier.
Well, that's true.
So the QR codes are kind of like, you know, kind of rough in some way. And the Microsoft tags are a little prettier. I guess that's a subjective call. But also, apparently, the Microsoft tags pick up quicker than the QR codes. So you don't have to actually, you know, line it up so much with the actual code itself. You just need to kind of throw it over it and immediately pop up the video. That's, I think, the reason they went with it is because it's quicker. It grabs the actual code quicker. So you have quicker access to the actual video itself than having to work on lining it up.
Yeah, it was very quick. I was struck by that. And you do give, you do tell people where to find the app for their smartphone. And for me, it was just a matter of going to Apple's, to the iTunes App Store and downloading the app. And I already had a couple of QR code readers, so I thought, oh, no, now I need another one. The great thing about this one, though, is that it reads not only the Microsoft tags, but also the other kind. So one could just could probably get along with just this one QR code reader, which is which is a nice feature.
Yeah. Well, let me just touch on that for a second, because I love what you said, how you know, you can get access to, you know, when you're interacting with these videos, you get access to not just me and the Now Effect, which is, you know, a wonderful, you know, supplement and resource in itself, but how it introduces you to so many different areas of mindfulness, just even being able to contact that. And again, you don't need the QR reader, even though it's a universal reader, the Microsoft tag reader. You can just go to the site where the link is itself, and it'll kind of do that for you.
Sure. Now, as I mentioned, I'm a big technophile myself, so I'm interested in this aspect of what you've done. Now, some people would maintain that technology is a big part of the problem in our distracted society. What's your thinking on this?
You know, it's interesting. I just wrote a blog on there was a article that came out in The Atlantic that was titled, "Is Facebook Making Us Lonelier?" And, you know, I've had some thoughts on this for a while, the idea of technology, and because I came out with an app, Mindful Solutions at Work, and some people wrote to me and said, you know, it's been helpful to an enormous amount of people, but some people wrote to me and said, you know, how dare you, use technology, because that's the problem. So you're just, you know, just putting out another problem out there in some way. Isn't this just distracting in some way? And so, you know, I see technology as a little bit different. And here's my thoughts on it. And this is what I wrote in the blog, is that technology is not the issue. Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, all these different things, our phones, you know, texting, none of that's a problem. These are all, in some ways, fantastic mediums that if we can harness the power of them, you know, they can really help us in our daily lives in a lot of ways. It's just that as a culture and individually, for the most part, for the most of us, we're not mature enough to handle these different mediums. And what I mean by that is they're so new. We might say for a lot of people, you know, especially a lot of people right now in their 20s and you know, even early 30s, they didn't ever even know a world without the internet or, you know, these phones. But even for a lot of us who did know the world without the internet or, you know, interaction with constant computer interaction, we're kind of absorbed in it at this point, and we almost can't imagine a world without it. It's kind of the idea of like when you forget your cell phone at home and you feel naked, you know, some way or vulnerable in some way because you don't have this phone. But it's not the phone or the technology. It's the way we interact with it. And that's the importance of bringing mindfulness to even technology. And, you know, what I wrote in that blog was, let's use this as the great experiment in some way. And as we're relating to it, let's see what's helpful to us about it and maybe what's a hindrance to us about it. So, for example, if I'm constantly being pulled by my phone in some way, at the expense of paying attention to my kids or doing my work, and I find myself getting more stressed and overwhelmed because I'm practicing what Linda Stone calls a continuous partial attention. A continuous partial attention. It's as if our attention is continuously kind of put out into a couple different areas, which taxes our brain. Then I know that's not really working for me. I don't need to judge myself for it necessarily, because implicit in mindfulness is this idea of a non-judgmental awareness. In other words, putting aside our biases for the moment and treating this as something, you know, new, fresh. And then getting our insights on it, what works for us, what doesn't work for us. The technology itself, again, I get things from, I'll just say this, I have this new online community that I created to support people with the Now Effect that gives them daily Now moments into their email box. And it's just short little insights that pop them into a space of awareness that give them things to reflect on or put or integrate into their day. But when people sign up for it, it lands them on my my Facebook page, which is just a general pool page that people are writing on and connecting around and whatever. It's just a good medium to do that with. So I get a couple emails from people that say, how dare you use Facebook? And most, by the way, most people don't say this, but there's just a few people who say, you know, I was going to subscribe to your community, but because there's Facebook involved, I'm not going to do this or something like that. And I think, okay, well, you know, that's their prerogative, but I think they're misunderstanding the use of that medium. The use of that medium, it's not Facebook. It's just that this is a way that people have found that they can connect and share things around. There's other mediums they can do that, like Google Plus and these different things. This is just one medium, and it's just the way we're relating to it that matters. It's not the medium that's the problem. I think that's the big take-home point.
Yeah. I was going to ask you if there were other ways you find technology useful for being in the now. And do you want to comment on that? Are there other ways or other apps that you find useful?
I do find some apps useful, actually. And I use one of them myself. But this is just particularly for taking time out to, you know, practice, just being with yourself, either with your breath, doing a mindfulness practice, or being with your body or whatever you start training in some ways, even if it's just for 5 or 10 minutes or 3 minutes or whatever, to just be here now, in other words. And I use this thing called Meditation Helper, which is an app that's free. And it allows me to just use, just kind of remind me, you know, when to practice. I can set it for that. And then it also tells me a time, or not even tell me, I can put in a time, 3, 5, 10, 20, 30, whatever minutes, that it's going to do that. At the end, it has a very nice bell that kind of alerts me that it's over. And I love that. Now, I often recommend to people that they take, let's say, you know, practices that, you know, I talk about, or just other practices like a stop practice, which is about stopping, taking a breath, observing your experience and proceeding. It's an acronym. It's in the now effect, or an ACE practice, which is getting an awareness of your experience, your body, your emotions, your thoughts, and then collecting your attention onto your breath and expanding your awareness throughout the body. That's like a 3-minute practice. I ask people to take those practices, and by the way, those practices are all in the Now Effect, and the stop practice is also freely available on YouTube online, so you can check that out. And you just Google my name and stop, a number of things will come up. And I tell people to put that in their calendars, because a lot of people, again, use these phones, so this is the digital world, as reminders to pop up as a time to practice. Now, the way our brains work is that we habituate to that kind of stuff, and we have to have an awareness of it. So you might put these things in your calendar, and eventually, and all of us experience this, eventually it doesn't really mean anything anymore. It's like art on our walls. That's why the idea is to kind of move around the different things in our houses from time to time to kind of keep a freshness there.
Yeah.
We stop seeing it. And so you might experiment with, and again, this is all an experiment in some way, allowing our experience to be our best teacher, putting it at different times during the day. You can also, what I think is wonderful, I don't really use Google Plus too much, but what I think is really interesting about it is this idea that they have all of these video windows that can pop up with like 6 people at a time, or maybe more, I'm not really quite sure. And that's a medium where maybe people can create a group around a mindfulness group, or a group around the Now Effect, or whatever they want to be working on. And they can connect around it and all sit and integrate a practice in that time, and then discuss their experience with that practice. That's another wonderful way of connection. Nowadays, if people can meet in person and do that, that's wonderful. But if they can't meet in person, not allowing that to be an obstacle to actually connecting with people, which is so supportive with practice. One of the things I didn't relay in my story, Dave, is that one of the things that was so helpful to me, in addition to integrating more of this work into my life when it came to making that really significant change, was finding a community of people who are supportive to me in that change. I mean, that's why we see AA, NA, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, these types of things that are so supportive to people. That wasn't my community that I found, but I connected with a community of people in the mindfulness world that were supportive to me in becoming more present to my life, having more compassion for myself, being more focused and embracing a sense of being productive and successful.
Okay, there are all these choice points that are coming up from what you've said.
Yeah.
One I want to ask you about still on, well, you mentioned Google Plus, and I'm just now getting into Google Plus. I'm giving a presentation at a conference in October, so I'm really trying to learn the ins and outs of it and get it under my belt. So I'd love to get into each other's circle, and we might be able to share one of those video times together with other people that you're involved with. So look for me on Google Plus. I'll look for you there.
Yeah.
You mentioned a name that I'm not familiar with, Linda Stone. What can you tell us about Linda Stone? Who is she?
Well, this Linda Stone, she just created that term continuous partial attention. And, you know, that's a phrase that, means a lot to me because it's something that I've experienced in my life. And it's this idea of kind of just splitting our awareness constantly. It's the idea that you're at the breakfast table and you're listening to your partner or whoever's with you. And at the same time, you're kind of checking your phone. And the person says, "Are you listening to me?" He said, "Yeah, I'm listening to you. I heard what you said. You said this, that, and the other." But you're not really paying attention. You know, even in the, when I'm training, psychotherapists, and mindfulness and psychotherapy, one of the basic things that I bring people through is this idea of mindful listening. And mindful listening, and this is just for anybody, for all of us, is this idea of really intentionally paying attention to what the other person is saying with an attitude of curiosity. And that doesn't happen when we're paying attention to multiple things at once. And that's what we're kind of losing out on, I'd say. You know, more in our lives.
Yeah. One more thing on technology and then I'll move on.
Yeah. No, I love technology. So
what about the software with binaural beats that's supposed to enhance, intensify meditation? Are you familiar with those sorts of applications that are out there?
No, I don't know that one, Dave.
Oh, okay. Well, we can talk about that when we get together on Google Plus.
Okay. All right. Great. Yeah. I'd like to know more.
Yeah. Discipline is something that many of us struggle with. Meditation is a great idea, but who has the time? And I love your golf ball story in this regard. I'm hoping you remember it and that you share it with us now.
Yeah, well, this is a popular story that's actually made its way, you know, around the web a number of times. And, you know, this is the idea of a professor who stands in front of a classroom and she has a big jar. And she is trying to relate to the class, like the idea of being able to pay attention to what really matters in life first. And so what she does is she takes the jar, and one of the things she puts in it to begin with is she puts a bunch of golf balls in there. And she asks the class, "Is this jar full?" And she fills the golf balls at the top, and the class says, "Yes, it's full." And then she takes pebbles and she puts those in the jar, and those fall in between the cracks of the golf balls, and she says, is this full now?" And they said, "Yes, now it's definitely full." And then she takes sand and she puts the sand in there, that fills the holes in between the pebbles, and she says, "Full now? Yes, it's full now." And then she takes her coffee and she dumps the coffee in and it fills in between the sand. And everyone's like, "Aha," and everyone has a good laugh. "Yeah, it's now full." And she asks, you know, the class, what does this mean? And she, and one of the classmates says, you know, this is kind of my little twist on it. You know, there's always a moment for a cup of coffee. And so everyone kind of there has a good laugh. But what she's basically getting at there is that, you know, in order to live in line with our values, one thing that we know is that when we're living in line with our values, we tend to be happy in life. It just makes us feel good when we're doing things that we intend to do in life, or doing things that are most meaningful to us, or doing things that matter. But when we pay attention to the small stuff in life that doesn't matter, that's like putting the sand in first. If you put the sand in first and then the pebbles, there's not going to be room for all the golf balls. there's not going to be room for even the pebbles, maybe. We have to bring our attention to what matters first, pay attention to that, and then the rest will follow. So the golf balls are things like our health, our family, our friends, these types of things. The pebbles are more things maybe like our job, the material things that we have or whatever. And the sand is maybe, all of the various small things that take our attention. Maybe we're overly paying attention to Twitter or Facebook or these types of things that, again, if we harness the power of them, we pay attention to them in ways that support us and then leave out the rest, they'd be great. So, that's what that is. I start it with that. Story, because I want people to start priming their minds towards paying attention to what matters. Why are they even picking up this book at all? And as they're going through the book, and being able to separate that space between stimulus and response, find that space of awareness, they can then reconnect to what really matters in their life or reconnect to what matters in that moment. But first they have to have an awareness of it. So hopefully what that does, and there's a now moment after that, which has people actually, create either on a piece of paper or actually physically in their life, that jar. What do those golf balls mean to them? What do those pebbles mean to them? What's the sand in their life? And be able to mark maybe what the golf balls are and put it in a prominent place so that it can be, again, a reminder to them of what really matters and to hopefully guide their attention towards that over and over again.
I took a little bit of a different point from the story, which was to... for me, it brought the awareness that, there was a room for the sand, and I think maybe even water at the end. I don't remember. But that we think we don't have time to meditate, but that there are actually these little interseas between the various things that we're doing throughout the day that we could bring mindfulness to.
I like that, too. Yeah. And that point that you make right there is woven throughout. The now effect, this idea of noticing where those in-between spaces are in our lives that are normally moments of frustration or moments of waiting or something like that, where we can then, shift our attention and recognize that this is a space of awareness that I can bring mindfulness to and start to train my brain to have this happen more automatically.
Yeah. You've got a short chapter titled Say Yes, and that's such a simple yet powerful idea. Just yesterday, I was reading about a speech that the Apple computer evangelist Guy Kawasaki gave about developing engagement through social networking. Actually, I read this as a result of something he posted on Google+. And he underscores how being critical of ideas tends to put people off, and saying yes draws them in. And this is something I continually need to remind myself of, because a big part of my training as a psychologist is not to accept ideas uncritically. What's your take on this?
Yeah. This is about those people who I would say have more of that yes in their life, have more of that openness, have more of that sense of curiosity, are attractive socially.
Yeah.
So there is something about that. Those of us who are able to or practice being aware of even those thoughts or the emotions that are here and being open to them, are able to work with them a little more effectively. I mean, there's a wonderful story in this chapter, just because you asked me to relate some of these stories, children's story. And it's a children's story. This guy Jack Kent, who's a British author, he wrote a story about a little boy and a dragon. And the little boy was sitting in his house, and there was a dragon, and he went, and it was a small little dragon, and he went to his parents, and he said, "Mommy, Daddy, there's a dragon here. There's a dragon in our house." And they said, no, there's no such thing as dragons. And he said, "Oh, okay, well, as kids, we believe what our parents say for the most part and absorb that, and we absorb beliefs and the way we see life from our parents and also our culture and whatnot." And so he decided that, there's no such thing as dragons. And so then the dragon got a little bigger. And he looked at the dragon and he said, "Well, there's really no such thing as dragons, so I'm going to continue on." It got a little bigger and a little bigger. Finally, it got so big that its limbs were outside of the house, and it was had actually moved the house. And the parents noticed that the house moved, and they said, "What happens?" And he said, "I'm telling you, there's a dragon here." And they said, "There's no such thing as dragons." And he said, "There is such things as dragons. The dragon's right here." And they saw the dragon in that moment. And in the moment that they saw it and they acknowledged that the dragon was here, it shrunk back to its small size. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's such a great metaphor for life when it comes to working with our difficult thoughts or difficult emotions or even the wonderful feelings that we have in life. This idea of saying yes, which is just a gentle acknowledgement of what's here, and kind of a leaning toward in some way instead of a moving away, allows those difficulties that we have in life to actually shrink. There's a wonderful research study that I mentioned in the book, Matthew Lieberman and Naomi Eisenberger at UCLA that did a research study on naming what the effects are in the brain of being able to recognize emotions. And they had two different groups looking at a picture of a man and a woman who had kind of an angry face and a fearful face. And under one group of pictures, it said Dick and Jane. Under the other group of pictures, anger and fear. And when they hooked them up to brain scanning machines, what they found was that the group that saw Dick and Jane had an increased firing in the area of the brain, the fear circuit called the amygdala. And the group that saw the one that said anger and fear had a reduction in activity in the amygdala, that fear circuit, or is also fires up with other different emotions, and an increased activity in the prefrontal cortex, which is more of the rational brain. And what's so interesting about that is when you're able to label and notice a feeling that's here, it seems to me that, you know, we feel now that there's a space in between our awareness and the feeling itself. So there's some room for perspective. There's also a sense that I can handle this. It's going to be okay. This isn't something that's enveloping me. This is something I'm relating to now instead of from. And so this say yes idea is so important. It's just a simple practice. Again, at the end, the now moment of that say yes chapter is just to, you know, notice what your dragons are in your life. What are the things you're saying no to, you know, the feelings or experiences, and see what it is. Again, just as an experiment. Throughout the day, when you notice a difficult feeling or something like that, just to say yes to it, a sense of welcoming, a sensing of allowing, a sensing of letting be in some way, and see what happens to it when you do that. That's the idea.
Yeah, and I think there's a meditative technique that kind of relates to what you've been saying of noticing and noticing without judging, labeling without judging, worrying about work. Noticing that and then kind of letting go of it, thinking about tomorrow, noticing that, letting go of it, and so on.
Uh-huh. So you're labeling the certain types of thoughts that are happening there.
Yeah.
And by doing that, again, you're stepping out of the autopilot of it. You're getting a space. This whole book is around recognizing spaces. So It's noticing that space between your awareness and the thoughts themselves. Once you do that, that space is a choice point. So that choice point might be to try and just let it go in some way or let it be in some way. If you let it be, it naturally starts to kind of come and go as all things do.
Yeah, it helps you to detach from it, you know.
Instead of getting wrapped up
in it and going round and round and round on thinking about work or thinking about tomorrow, to just kind of notice that and then let go of it.
And an important piece of this, Dave, is that, and again, this is based on basic learning theory. And once you intentionally practice and repeat something over time, it starts to become automatic. So the more you're able to get these spaces, this space between your awareness and your experience, and step into what is called these choice points that are here, the more likely that's starting to become automatic. So you kind of shift that rapid cognition, that subconscious thinking that's there that we're not necessarily aware of, in favor of the way that you want to go. And that's the whole purpose behind the now effect. That's the purpose behind mindfulness in general in some ways, is to be able to kind of retrain your brain through intentional practice and repetition over time, to incline it in the directions that are more supportive to you over time.
A lot of people are concerned about their weight, and I gather you have some ideas about how being in the now might help them achieve their weight goals.
Yeah, you know, there's a chapter in here called Now on Your Diet, and in that chapter we're talking about, you know, our relationship to food. And it's not about creating a particular diet. There's no like diet prescription in it at all. It's more about taking a step back and seeing what happens when you engage mindfulness with eating. There's been a lot around mindful eating lately. I think I actually wrote a blog recently called The Slow Eating Diet, which is based a bit on Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Vietnamese Buddhist monk and a wonderful mindfulness teacher and peace activist. He's written a ton of good books and just a very gentle man. And he has this kind of practice where he says, you know, try chewing 30 times. I had a client who was having terrible stomach issues. And when I told him to do this, I said, well, why don't you bring mindfulness to this? Why don't you try chewing? And this is really hard. A lot of people have a reaction to this, chewing 30 times. That sounds crazy. But, you know, try and see if you can slide underneath the judgment of that and just treat this as an experiment. And as he started doing this more often, not only did he realize that after a while he stopped counting, he actually tasted more of the food that was there, but his stomach issues started going away. And his stomach issues were mainly attributed to, could have been stress, but also the fact that he was just eating so quickly, his body was having difficulty actually digesting the food that was there. And when it's broken down in your mouth more, the body has an easier time digesting it. There was another woman that I was working with who had a problem with her weight. She also was a binge eater. She would go by like a bakery almost every day and come home with like a cake and eat the cake and have real feelings of remorse and shame afterwards. She'd go through this whole process. And, you know, what we had her do was shift her perspective in some way of that urge, that feeling, that physical impulse that comes up in relationship to food sometimes, not when we're really hungry, but when we're using it as a way to distract or avoid ourselves, avoid some difficult feeling that's there, and use that as something that was reaching up and becoming a reminder that right now is a choice point. Right now is a moment I can choose. It's almost like that feeling, that impulse, the constriction of the chest, the watering in the mouth was now conditioned in her mind to bring up at the same time this idea that this is a choice point right now. And what she did was worked with a lot of what we work with in the working with difficult emotions section in the Now Effect, which was how to learn how to relate to this feeling differently, inclining towards it and creating space around it. And eventually getting to the place where this thought comes up in the mind, it's going to be okay. And she came to a place where she was able to relate to food differently. She actually started losing weight. And again, change didn't happen in this just very linear fashion. She kind of worked with it and she slipped at times back and forth. But what she did more than anything was just by starting to bring mindfulness to her diet, to the way she was relating to food, it started having ripple effects in other areas of her life, including relationships, including her own stress, including how she focused at work. And that's what the gift of this really is. That's the effect of it. And that's why I titled this book The Now Effect, because it's not so much about, you know, let's give this general theory of mindfulness. It's about what's the effect of this and how can we recognize more of the effects more often so they start becoming more automatic in our lives. And that's the key.
You talk about working with difficult emotions. What about anger? Where does that fit in?
Anger is oftentimes a confusing emotion. And what I mean by that is there's some people who say that anger is like a bad emotion in some way, or emotion that's not helpful, or we need to get rid of it, or whatever it is. But anger itself, there's nothing wrong with anger. Again, we're bringing this kind of, we're stripping aside our biases of whether something is good or bad or right or wrong. Instead, we're looking at the feeling that's there, and it could be something that's actually constructive. Maybe we've been kind of a doormat all our lives, being walked over by people because we're afraid of conflict, and we have this real inner anger and frustration that's there that's trying to tell us to kind of stand up and be assertive in our lives, and it's important to pay attention to that. However, the way we want to relate to it, where it becomes destructive, is where we're really aggressive, like we're shouting at people, or we're calling people names, or being condescending, or being passive aggressive in some way, or actually, if there's any kind of physical abuse, of course, that's very overtly dangerous. And so, but anger can be constructive, and the way we want to work with it is by kind of taming it in some way. Dan Siegel has this this quote that's been attributed to him, which is "Name it to tame it," which is the idea of when you can name the anger that's there, then you can feel into it, the actual feeling as it is physically in the body, and learn to incline into it with a sense of understanding that you're the one who's suffering right now. You're the one who's in pain. And is there a way to relate to it with more of a kind, friendly type of attention? Mm-hmm. And this seems so strange until you start actually practicing this. And maybe then what comes up is this belief that you have that, I'm the world's out to get me, or, you know, I've always been oppressed or something like that. I'm a victim in some way. And, you know, you can begin working with that belief, because that's a deep thought that you, it seems very convincing. And there are times that we're victims in life, but at times having that mentality can really hold us back. And that's a talk for an entire other hour.
Yes, right. Yeah. Right. As I was going through the book, I got the impression that you've been following developments in positive psychology and the study of happiness, as have I. What impact is positive psychology having on your thinking and teaching?
Well, it's interesting because in the field of mindfulness, which kind of precluded positive psychology, which came out in the early part of the century, which is kind of fun to say that now, part of the century.
Right.
Which is kind of focusing on not just the psychology of people as a disease model, which is let's see what's wrong with us and get us to status quo, but more seeing if we can embrace and deepen with the feelings of goodness that's there. And, you know, you see that in the field, in the section Priming Your Mind for Good. And for me, it sets the seeds for resiliency. You know, if we're feeling a sense of joy, gratitude, a sense of altruism, or if we're feeling these feelings more often in our life and something difficult comes to get us or comes at us, it's going to hit us more in a way where it's going to bounce off us more easily. And one, you know, wonderful study that was probably one of the earliest studies in the field of neuroscience that came out was Richie Davidson's study in 2003, that showed people who went through a mindfulness training and those that didn't go through a mindfulness mm-hmm. training, and showed the shift into the left prefrontal cortex with those that actually did the mindfulness training, which is more associated with positive emotions. And what they also found was the group that did that had a greater resistance to the flu antibodies that were there. So it showed that maybe they had a greater sense of physical health, showing that sense of resiliency. And you can just, and this is easy to see, if you're feeling good and someone walks by you and gives you kind of a snide look, you might think, what's wrong with them? But if you're feeling like anxious or depressed and someone walks by you and gives you a snide look, you might think, what's wrong with me? The thoughts themselves aren't facts. The event is exactly the same. But when we're able to cultivate more joy, more goodness in our life, if we can get rid of the judgments around that, that's some kind of Pollyanna approach towards things, but these are real innate qualities within us, and we can start to nurture those, we start to become more resilient towards the difficulties that are there. Also have a greater sense of compassion when the difficulties are there, which helps them kind of pass and even become more meaningful at times and pass sooner. You know, just a very quick story about that. Years ago, I was living in Mountain View, and I was walking in this place called Shoreline Park, and I had just learned that someone close to me had passed away, and I had felt this great sadness that was there, a lot of grief, and I was really resistant to it. I was suffering a lot in that moment, and I went along and walked along this park, and this park has a lake, and I chose to kind of sit down and bring my attention to the actual feeling, the sadness that was there. I put my hand on my heart, and as if I was kind of putting my arm around myself, you know, in some way. And what I felt was a sense of peace in that moment. It could have something to do with the environment in the lake that was there, a sense of peace, though. And it turned from a sadness into a sweet sadness. Mm-hmm. And that was the effect of learning how to relate to myself with greater compassion. Yes. And when we're talking about positive psychology, it's talking about integrating some of the good in life, and compassion is one of those things.
Yes, yes. Well, we've covered so much ground here, and there's so much more that we could cover and that you do cover in your book, but it's about time for us to wrap it up. I'm wondering if there's any last point you'd like to leave our listeners with.
I would just leave them with this last point. You know, some of you might have heard this quote before, because I've I've said it a lot in my life, but it's really kind of the foundation for the Now Effect. The Now Effect is a great exploration in a lot of ways and practical application of this in our daily lives, which is Viktor Frankl's quote, which he was a psychiatrist, a Holocaust survivor, who was able to change his relationship to the difficulties in his life to find greater meaning and live a very meaningful life. And it's in between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space lies our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. This work is about finding those spaces, being able to tune into those spaces in our lives where those choice points lie, where the opportunities and possibilities and a greater sense of freedom lies in our life. And the purpose is to elongate those spaces, to widen those spaces of awareness. And just in the way that we start to intentionally pay attention to them, we naturally start to widen them and recognize that we do have more opportunities, there is more possibility, and there is a greater sense of growth and power and freedom that's actually here right now, and we can tap into it, but it just has to do with training our brains to do that, and it's good to do in kind of short and small ways in our lives.
Well, that's a great way to wrap it up, and Dr. Elisha Goldstein, it's great to talk to you again, and I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
And thank you, Dave.
I hope you found this most recent conversation with Dr. Elisha Goldstein both informative and interesting. You might also want to listen to my 2008 interview with his psychologist wife, Dr. Stephanie Goldstein, whose focus is on mindfulness in the treatment of addiction. As you heard in the interview, Elisha's book, The Now Effect, is extremely readable and practical. I'm happy to endorse it for anyone who is interested in mindfulness or who is struggling with anxiety, depression, or other difficult emotions. The chapters are very short and very clear, and the exercises at the end of each one will help you to ground the ideas in your own experience. If you do decide to buy a copy for yourself or as a gift for someone you know, be sure to use the Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site. And for more information about the Drs. Goldstein and links to their various materials and productions, you can go to their site at http://drsgoldstein.com. And Drs. Goldstein is spelled DrsGoldstein.
Looking for a way to make it personal and thank Dr. Dave? You can by paying it forward. It's easy. Just go to the Shrink Wrap Radio homepage and click on the big green donate button. You can donate a little or donate a lot, but be sure to remember to donate and to keep the programming in the green and in your ears.
Thanks, Mike West, for that promo idea of paying it forward. And thanks to all of those of you who have already made one-time or ongoing contributions. Your support is greatly appreciated. Man, it's hard to believe it's Friday again already. Wow, time just goes speeding by, and these podcasts, interviews just keep coming on. You should now be seeing 6 social sharing buttons beneath each episode. The trade-off is that the page takes longer to load, but it does make it easier for you to share these episodes with your friends and networks and social networks. However, I heard from Lisa Shalfoon, whose idea this was, that she's not seeing the button that lets you send an email to friends. Now, I've checked it out on both the Mac and Windows with Firefox, Chrome, and Internet Explorer. If you're not seeing that mail icon, would you please let me know and tell me whether you're on a Mac or Windows PC and what the browser is that you're using? Thanks. Lisa came up with another excellent suggestion. If there are one or more volunteers out there who want to take it on, she suggests reposting interviews on YouTube with pretty pictures that would change as the audio plays. There are some examples of that sort of thing up there. I don't have time to execute this idea, but I think it could be a good one. I've even thought of possibly doing some of the interviews using video, though most of my guests are not set up on Skype for that. However, I'm not sure YouTube allows videos as long as these interviews take. I'm going to have to look into that, or maybe one of you can write and tell me. Speaking of volunteers, I believe Reinhardt is still looking for a co-facilitator for our Yahoo group. As I mentioned last week, the group has around 50 members but doesn't have a lot of activity currently. Now, Reinhardt is hoping someone will step forward to be a co-facilitator to help breathe more life into the group. And there's no single topic that you're restricted to. It's really up for grabs in terms of whatever you want to discuss. So if you have some time, energy, and or interest to co-facilitate, please let either Reinhardt know directly on Yahoo in that group, or let me know and I'll pass him the pass on the info to him. Also, I'm still hoping to meet some of you on Google+. There's now a Shrink Wrap Radio page on Google+, which I'm hoping you can find. If you will, quotes, follow me on Google+, I will then be able to add you to my Shrink Wrap Radio circle, and we can meet in a video hangout. At least that's how I think it works. You have to follow me before I can add you to one of my circles. Also, don't forget to go to our new Facebook Shrink Wrap Radio page and like the show there. Finally, for those of you who live anywhere near the Bay Area or who are willing to travel, don't forget the International Association for the Study of Dreams is holding their 29th annual international conference titled Sailing on the Sea of Dreams at the Berkeley Marina Doubletree Hotel this year, June 22nd through the 26th. I'll be there, so if you go, look for me. And to register, you can go to www.asdreams.org.
Hi there. This is Dr. Maggie Phillips. I'm a psychologist, hypnotherapist, and pain specialist, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
And, of course, Dr. Maggie Phillips will be my next guest, and she works with Dr. Peter Levine, who many of you will have heard of. More about that in a bit. Let's dip into the old mailbag. Email bag, that is. I received a long comment on number 304 with Dr. Arlene Landau on tragic beauty. I invite you to read this comment for yourself. It's too long to read it all here, but it's a very thoughtful post and an articulate one from New York actress Rima Zaman. And in part, she writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, thank you for the gift of your words, inspiring voice, and insights. You treat each guest with such warmth and compassion, giving them a safe and vibrant space, and it is no wonder they grace us with interviews that are truly incredible. Your son Matthew was the one who initially introduced me to your work in Shrink Wrap Radio, and I'm now happily hooked. The moment I saw the title of this particular interview, I was so excited to listen to it for a variety of reasons. I'm a writer, actress, and singer, and double majored in theater and women's studies at Skidmore College. My thesis dealt largely with beauty, mythology, and female archetypes as traced through Greek tragedy, pop culture, media, and literature. My work at this very moment explores these topics, in particular, beauty myths and archetypes as seen in the contemporary woman's condition or myth cycle, our modern day fairy tale. You can imagine I was already smiling this big waiting for the podcast to load. A few points in particular resonated with me quite deeply. As noted earlier, understanding beauty and the female condition is a large part of my path in life. As with any power, beauty carries with it great shadow and light, especially in our present climate. I really appreciate and empathize with your point about how, as a world culture and family, we are in a toxic place. Forgive me for paraphrasing, she says. I agree. I think we are living in such a dark time. I feel a deep-rooted need and responsibility to raise the necessary questions, to invoke honest conversation and action that somehow addresses this toxicity. As a daughter, a sister, and a hopeful future parent, it's all I can think about, and I work from that impetus. Also, I'm not from the United States and have my own understanding of beauty, gender roles, etc., collected from different cultures. I was born in Bangladesh, lived in Hawaii until I was 6, then in Thailand until I was 18, and moved to the U.S. for school and work. The women in my immediate family and the spiritual sisters and mothers I have been blessed to meet through my meanderings, we have our own mythology and history with beauty, the female body's currency, and the traditional roles men and women play. Our archetypes are the same, though, of course, and that's why it's all so fascinating. While the details manifest in different ways, we still embody many of the same shadows and light. Furthermore, in my day-to-day as a 28-year-old singer and actress, I find myself thoroughly embedded in the dark, murky mix that is pop culture, and it creates an interesting balancing act with my personal politics and creative journey, trying to write songs that appeal to a large audience, while at the same time don't reinforce harmful, antiquated messages about men and women, and actually move and challenge the listener, is a humbling, exciting process. It's a dialogue that I love and invite. And so I thank you, because through your calling and gift, you too move this conversation along. You bring and give so much to your audience, and we are grateful. Well, she goes on for another couple of paragraphs, which I won't read here, but encourage you to seek out and even to post your own comments in response. And she gives us a link to a YouTube video that she made. She says, this is a satire performance piece called I Made a Sex Tape, which looks at sex, voyeurism, celebrity, toxicity, all that jazz. Enjoy. Now, her satirical video is a perfect complement to the points Dr. Landau was making in The Dark Side of Beauty. So let's help Rima Zaman's I Made a Sex Tape go viral. You can find it by searching on YouTube by that title or her name, or see the link in the comments area for Shrink Wrap Radio number 304. Okay, due to the length of this podcast, I think that will wrap it up for today. So as always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows on the comments area of the site, just as you heard Rima do. And you can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod. You can also leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. And don't forget, you can go to the Apps tab on our site for information about getting our iPhone, iPad, iPod Touch / Android app, and you can contact me directly through that. Thanks again to Dr. Elisha Goldstein for sharing his work on mindfulness and the now effect. As I mentioned, my next interview will be with psychologist, hypnotherapist, and pain expert Dr. Maggie Phillips, who has long worked with Dr. Peter A. Levine using his somatic experiencing approach, which they write about in their new book, Freedom from Pain. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.